and brightest day, in blackest night, all other podcasts tremble in fright. Losers cower before the power. Orange is lust, and blues you can trust. Indigos feel, and white ones heal. Yellow scare, and green ones dare. That sapphire love and black hands glove will rock your foundation without hesitation. Chad and Mars face evil's might. Respect their power, for they'll make you see the light.
Hi, everybody. I'm Chad Bokelman.
I'm Mark Marble.
And this is the Lantern Cast.
Episode 628, I think. I just went blank, but I'm looking at the issue and trying to concentrate on the issue at hand. But yet, literally, 628 actually is the episode. At least I absorbed that correctly.
Core 11, right?
Oh, yes. Green Lantern Core 11.
Well, we got some other stuff to get into tonight, so let's just jump right in, I think.
Let's just bite the bullet. This is a busy issue. I guess that's the simple. There's
not a lot happening, but still busy.
I guess it's somewhat debatable whether there's not a lot happening. But the point, but there's like four or five different friggin' plots going on at the same time. So it's not an easy issue to read and follow. Let's put it that way. Yes, is most of it important? Probably not, but nonetheless. So let's just jump into this. We pick up where we left off last time with the water blob, who was Enquar, and now we find out why he is Enquar, because his planet was Enquar, and they were a hive mind race of beings that lived in the ocean, and he's the last one left. And the reason he's the last one left is because in their infinite wisdom — this does sound like something the Guardians would oversee, though we don't really get a time frame for when this happened, I don't believe, but then again, we... As we found out with John Stewart being gone, how they described it, for that, no matter how we try to justify it, that period of time he was gone, even if they gave us a time frame, it doesn't really help us in comic book issues to know how long it's been. But the Green Lantern Corps basically helps this other race of beings whose planet was destroyed, at least according to this biased narration and view, that this planet, their original planet, was destroyed because of themselves, that they destroyed it. They polluted it, used it all up, and spat it out. And the Green Lantern Corps said, hey, here's another planet for you. We can't detect any real life or sentient life on this planet at all. Or they didn't bother looking in the oceans. So here, take this water world and make it yours. And of course, they pollute and destroy this world. And the being called Enquar now is the only one of his people who survived, and he basically made it off world by hiding in their water supplies. And I guess that's when he kind of eventually figured out his neat little trick of he could stay hydrated by sucking the moisture out of people as he takes over their form for a period of time. And he's telling all this to Fatality to try to convince her to join him, which I do like the fact that she's right off the bat, she's like, this guy's nuts. But of course, he's telepathic, so that kind of works against her on one level. But that's later on in the issue, not in a dramatic fashion, but the fact that if she thought her thoughts were her own, they are not. One of the subplots on the planet in this issue is all these new recruits are being trained by Guy and Kilowog to use their twins, their energy twins, where basically they can just create a, like, almost like a living energy construct of themselves and send them off. So they could do covert missions and all this stuff, and they can fly at light speed, I believe, and no one supposedly can see these constructs except other Green Lanterns. And so there's a subplot, but everybody's kind of able to do it initially, but Aya can't, because Aya seemingly doesn't have a soul, and that's the logical assessment of why she might not be able to do it. Ellie's on the surface of Mogo. The Blue Lanterns are going on their annual pilgrimage. Where and why this started, we don't know. We get no details. I guess they're going with Mogo to this, or on Mogo. We don't know, because Ellie's kind of jumping the gun. She's on, you know, she's going on the plant on Mogo first because she feels comfortable there, because there's a whole bunch of kind of like sentient energy constructs that Mogo has created. So she feels like she fits in there. While she's on the surface of the planet, out of the ground, bubbling up is an old friend of ours, Effigy. We will talk about Effigy. Now, meanwhile, on Owa, we're also dealing with Razor, who obviously has become this de facto, which is annoying, leader of the Red Lanterns. He and Arkillo, poor Arkillo. Arkillo, I guess, is the designated poster boy, I guess, to defend the Yellow Lantern. So he and Razor are duking it out, and the Green Lanterns are trying to separate them. John gets recruited to go help out, deal with Effigy. And, of course, John should know who Effigy is because he was around during that time. He was friends with Kyle. I think he might. I'm trying to remember if he had his ring again back then. But either way, he should know Effigy, period, because of Kyle in his relationship with Effigy. But his ring has to give him a primer on who Effigy is, just for John to go, oh, yeah, I remember this guy. I know this guy. Then why are you asking what the deal is with Effigy, for the most part? Ellie and John were fighting Effigy. Seemingly, Ellie gets destroyed, which freaks John out, and John's on the verge of almost killing Effigy, and Effigy kind of says, well, I've kind of had enough of this. I don't really care who freed, you know, I don't care that he freed me, that it's not really worth it. I basically just want to go to the light, and he flies off to the sun, the closest sun, I guess. Razor and Arkillo are still duking it out, and Razor screams, and that all of a sudden makes Aya able to have her energy twin who goes to comfort Razor, and they end up having a moment and they kiss and blah, 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 blah. Jessica makes an appearance, yelling at everybody, saying, you're going to the principal's office. Come see me, because all these lantern cores are not getting along like they're supposed to. And Ellie heals Mogo's wounds again, and somehow stupid John Stewart's ring, which is really annoying, makes it sound like this is unique. It's like, I don't think we've ever seen Blues do anything like this before. I guess minus the fact that, you know, St. Walker and Brother Worth healed an entire sun and stopped it from going supernova, the first time we ever saw Blue Lanterns working with a green. But other than that, that point seems valid. And then we get back to Enquar, who he has a ship. But part of the reason why he had this other ship meet them was so he could suck this pilot dry and absorb their energy. And he makes it clear that, oh, yeah, I can read your mind, Fatality, but I don't really need you, but I want you to help me because of the fact that what the Green Lanterns did to all of us, that this, you know, that we should, you know, basically we should be in tandem working together to take them out. That's essentially the issue.
Yeah. Where do you want to start?
One thing I feel compelled to start with. Over the last few months, we've gotten these ridiculous editor's notes, which are not only just kind of like self-serving, but it's almost on the masturbatory level about, oh, the classic Dark Crisis. Oh, the classic all-in-one one-shot. And yet, if there ever was a time to give us an editor's note, it was telling us about Effigy. Because if anybody knew Effigy was killed by the Spectre, and what was it? That was the Crispus Allen? It's Allen, right? I always want to say Addix, but it's Allen, right? Crispus Allen?
Was that? I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. The least known and least popular host the Spectre really has ever had, somewhere during Final Crisis, yes, Final Crisis, which most people didn't particularly like, and certainly they weren't reading all these obscure one-shots for the most part. In that one-shot, the Spectre, killed Effigy, quote-unquote, basically melted him down into a pseudo-Green Lantern power battery, and that's when Effigy was done away with. I never knew that. I never read that one shot. I think a lot of people, even if you did know it at the time, that was 2008. So most people forgot it, but a lot of people would have no idea, because we've been so long since we've seen Effigy in a Green Lantern comic. This would have been a beautiful time to give us an editor's note, at least reminding us where that happened, when Effigy refers to being trapped in the battery. Just like, when the hell did the Green Lantern Corps get custody of this battery? Because seemingly the way he got freed was because they lost track of where the battery was during this whole Starbreaker mess. That's like a DC editorial in a nutshell. It's like, if you ever needed an editor's note, that would have been the perfect time to tell somebody. But no.
Yeah. In retrospect, that's definitely a little iffy. I downloaded Final Crisis Revelations and pulled up. It's literally just two pages. You didn't mention if you went back and actually read it or not, did you?
No, but it's that one page, like the one page that I cut to you when I found out what issue it was. Just when the actual page of him destroying Effigy, and it's like it's
two pages.
Yeah, it's an interesting punishment, but I don't know where he got that battery from either. But then again, I didn't read the issue. You might.
Yeah, it looks like it just appears out of white energy, which, you know, that's its own thing. Yeah. But it's literally at the beginning of Final Crisis Revelations. It's basically the first guy that Spectre goes after is Dr. Light. He's got a bunch of Dr. Light. Anyway, he's got a bunch of people who are in a bunch of girls in a hotel room, and he made them dress up as like Donna Troy and Starfire and stuff like that. And it's very clear he's about to do some really sus stuff to these girls. But it opens with, you know, the Spectre getting vengeance on Dr. Light, and, you know, he sort of melts him into wax or something like that, something crazy. So it's just basically it's used as a part of showing that the Spectre is going on a tear. It's setting up the whole thing. And just, you know, effigy or Martin Van Wyck, as he says, Martin Van Wyck, effigy, your judgment is at hand. You are a murderer, a criminal without morals or regret. As you burned in life, so shall you burn in death. So he just shoves him into this battery, and we see the battery behind the Hollywood Hills sign. That's it. It doesn't get like thrown into space like like at the end of Aladdin when Genie flicks Jafar's lamp off into space or whatever, off into the distance. It just gets left behind, and we don't really see what happens to it. Unless there's effigy appears elsewhere in this story. That's literally all it is. It's just used as fodder to show Spectre going on a tear.
Yeah. So the fact that, I mean, you give props, and we thought, I mean, about effigy coming back, because again, we it's been forever since we've seen effigy, but if you're going to bring him back, at least reference, I mean, since it's one of the most obscure ways a character and issues that a character is going to be wiped out in, that, yeah, don't bother telling us, you know, just, you know, go patting yourself on the back or any other part of your body you want to talk to about issues that nobody really absolutely cares about that have come out recently and that are hardly classics. But yes, don't even give us it makes you long for the old days when we used to joke about doing some of the older issues that we would review, and like almost every single damn page had at least one editor's note in a panel, if not multiple editor's notes in multiple panels on every page. It's like, it makes you wish for that, because at least they're being thorough, as opposed to, yeah, we don't need to explain this.
Yeah. The rest of this, I don't really feel like I got anything out of this issue. I Mark and I were joking off air, you know, in preparation for doing this episode about it being crap or whatever. I don't think it's bad necessarily. It's just, it didn't do anything for me. We're sort of progressing the plot a little bit in terms of, you know, our John, you know, sort of making his reentry into the core or whatever, and coming to grips with what's going on with, well, he doesn't really even address the ring issue, but you know, Ellie, and, you know, it at least it's dealt with pretty quickly. It doesn't seem like we're gonna draw this out, because at the end he's like, you know, she's not my sister, but I'm done pretending she's not family. So, like, okay, that's
progress.
That's progress. We're not going to draw this out. We're going to continue training these folks. We focus a bit on Aya and her relationship with Razor. She is able to make these soul construct energy twins, whatever we're calling them, things. And we're setting up some tension between some lanterns, but everything I'm saying is basically it's set up. So it feels like a filler issue.
Yeah. I mean, I would agree for the most part. I mean, we get inside Ellie's head a little bit, which I think that works. I think that works because, I mean, she acknowledges, you know, something that, you know, the other John Stewart should have thought of. And we know he just kind of like half-assed this whole creation of her, the idea that, and arguably with the ring, with the AI and the ring and all this stuff, and I don't know how that all happened too, but the reality is, with Ellie in particular, since he directly created her to help watch over their mother, that at least she acknowledges that, well, basically John never really thought this out. It's like, well, when mom didn't really need me anymore, then what was my role going to be? What was my purpose? What was going to happen to me then? So some inner soul searching for someone who's technically not really alive, I guess. So she should be, she's the one who really should be buddy buddies with Aya, not really freaking Kelly. Or she and Kelly, it should be her and Aya, because they have a lot in common there, because they're not truly alive, but yet there's more under the hood than just some artificial body or artificial construct created body, that trying to acknowledge that, you know, I don't really know where I belong. And in a way, you know, she's hurt kind of by John pushing her aside and ostracizing her, but yet she can understand it. It's really John Stewart's ring that's annoying as hell. That is, it's so funny. We go from it being ignored for like how many issues, and now it's like, oh my God, it's like, it's your sister. And at least I do respect the fact that this John Stewart just, he calls the ring on its shit pretty quickly. It's like, she's not my sister. So, but that's going to get real old real quick. So I got to be honest with you. I kind of hope they do away with that AI Shirley Stewart stuff sooner rather than later. I don't remember Effigy talking like this either. Throwing the ain'ts out and all this stuff right before, at the end of when he's squaring off with John at the very end. I don't remember him being like bro Effigy. I don't kind of remember him talking like that. I could be wrong. I could be confusing him maybe with Nero, but I didn't think that's the way Effigy talked. I'm sure you could explain it away because, oh, but would you talk differently too if you got melted into a power battery? I don't know.
I think it's correct because Nero had an inflated sense of self-importance and destiny. So he had a bit of, didn't he have like a bit of, God, I don't even know what the word would be for it. Nero was
more of the polar opposite Bizarro Kyle, because he was creative. You know, he kind of created things and drew things and like Kyle did. Effigy was like the first attempt to give Kyle his own arch villain, but they were not polar opposites.
I'm pretty sure Nero had like a bunch of I don't know, bombastic phrases and stuff, you know, he just a bunch of inflated self-importance and stuff like that, him being a god and, you know, that kind of shit.
I just don't remember Effigy talking as uneducated, if for lack of a better way of describing it, as he kind of does here. I could be wrong, but it's been so long since I read an issue with Effigy in it. But that just struck me a little bit. It's not a make or break thing. It kind of bugged me literally when Arkillo and Razor are fighting, and I'm really getting sick and tired of Arkillo kind of. He doesn't truly get the shitty end of the stick here, but he's close to getting it for a while. But literally you have Kilowog and Guy talking within earshot of Razor and Arkillo talking all about the Yellows. All about the Yellows and how, hey, you know, this is probably Sinestro's master plan to take over. And then Razor comes up with this stupid stuff. It's like, the Yellow Lanterns steal our belongings and encroach on our land, and you're taking their side, Kilowog? How is he taking their fucking side? If you heard what they were saying, and maybe you didn't, all they're talking about, oh yeah, it's probably the Yellow Lanterns that are causing this. All they're trying to do is break up the stupid fight. So that seems a bit much. That seems to be like the Red Lantern energy, you will, maybe corrupting Razor's thought process a tad and rushing and doing this. And oh yeah, nobody could possibly think that maybe it's Larfleeze that's actually stealing their shit. I don't know. There's a lot going on here. I don't know how much. I don't know how much I really care about this. The Enquire stuff is moderately interesting, but again, we have to openly acknowledge that Enquire is probably potentially an unreliable narrator. So his version of what happened is not necessarily verbatim what happened. There could be a whole missing piece of the story here. But it's weird. I don't know. It's okay. I mean, I don't really quite know what Fatality is going to do here. It's like it seems like Fatality doesn't have a choice, or she acts like she doesn't have a choice here, because if she resists this guy, he's just going to take her form next. So I guess she's going to be working with him until probably until the right moment when she teams up with Jon Stewart to stop him. But I don't know. It was okay. I think it was too busy. It would have been better if it wasn't as busy. I think they could have cut out a few of these subplots in this issue, maybe, and focus on the ones that they still included.
Yeah, I like the art also for the most part, except I had some problems with the Ellie scenes on Mogo, specifically before, I guess the one or maybe two pages, two, one and a half pages right before Effigy shows up. That may be more coloring than art, just because, I don't know, Mogo's construct animals are this weird piss lime green thing.
That's probably just to try to drive her point across, drive it home that he makes basically sentient constructs too, and to make, so it's a different color to kind of just denote that. I'm going,
maybe I thought it looked weird. Also, like, it's not even like necessarily something throughout the entirety of the comic, but there's just weird moments artistically. For instance, when our first scenes of the group's training session on Oa, at Malachite City or whatever, there's the first page where they're sitting on the roof and everybody's projecting energy constructs of themselves. And then there's the second page where we see Razor and Arkillo and other Red Lanterns and stuff go flying through the sky. They lift off the roof. Guy looks awful right there. He's got his symbol on the bottom right corner of his jacket, of his vest, like down by his hip. He looks emaciated almost.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah, there's just, I mean, like, for the most part, I like the art. I want to say like 85-90% of the time, but there's a couple of moments here and there I'm like, what is going on? So, but I mean, I don't even know if I can pin that on a specific artist, because there are two of them in this issue.
I'm sure you probably could, because
what I'm saying is, though, I think each of them has moments where their art looks weird.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But it's probably safe to say that you have like the, who's doing the John Ellie effigy is different than who's obviously doing the Razor and the Razor Arkillo battles. So, yeah. I mean, Arkillo's another one that, until you get close to Arkillo, he looks halfway decent. When you finally get that one, you get that shot of Arkillo's face, like when Jessica's reading him the Riot Act, that looks like hot garbage. But
yeah, the stuff with that is the non effigy John Kelly stuff, or Ellie stuff.
Ellie, yeah.
Is very anime cartoonish style. Whereas the rest of it is more realistic or maybe house style, whatever you would call it, kind of a thing. It almost kind of reminds me a little bit of Daryl Banks in some ways, because of Daryl did lots of inking work. I feel like, did he have, I don't know. I'm looking at the ink work and it's just reminding me of Daryl in some ways.
You mean the effigy parts and things like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see that. And the art is also, and probably it's the same artist, probably. There's a bunch of artists. There's three artists listed.
Oh, I thought there was two.
No, there's Conrad, Carlo Magno, and Dunbar. So there's three. But the artwork dealing with Fatality and Enquire, or whatever his name is, that art's pretty good. That art with those characters is mostly good too. But yeah, it's the stuff on the surface of Oa for the most part, and dealing with the recruit. I mean, Aya looked fine too. So it could be one of those things where, again, so, you know, certain artists have issues with drawing certain characters, and that could be the case. But I do agree with you. The stuff with effigy, especially on the surface of Mogo, that kind of appropriately does seem Daryl-like, at least in style.
Agreed. That's all I really got to say about this. I was disappointed in this because it felt like a filler issue, but it has its positive points in terms of like, okay, we're progressing the story here. It's not a filler issue in that there's that nothing worthwhile happens. We're moving plot forward a little bit, you know, mounting tensions between lanterns, John, you know, we're not going to, like I said earlier, we're not going to focus on this thing with Ellie. So like, okay, we're moving forward a little bit, but it just feels like a non-issue. But again, I want to reiterate, since Morgan Hampton has taken the reins solo, I do like what we're doing here. We've got Kat Matui back. We've got Effigy. We've got We've got Fatality working here. Kyle is a part of this book, I imagine, at some point. Or is he part of is he supposed to be a part of GL? I guess we'll find out whenever Hal goes back into space in like 3 issues, right?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. But I mean, even if we don't have Kyle, like, you know, we've got some glimpses of Kyle's past and his era in this pretty heavily with these first two. So I think we're good. I would have wanted more out of this issue, I think, is all I got to say.
Which is, I know what you mean, but it's ironic because obviously we got arguably too much from different stories and one issue perspective, but I know what you mean. I think in a way that to me, that's the tragedy in all this, Jordan, is the fact that there's just too many subplots in one issue. You got the Enquar thing, you have the training of the Lanterns, you have the tensions between the Lanterns, which of course we know is coming, but you could have at least, that could have been, you could have kicked that down the road a little bit. You didn't need to dive into it immediately. I mean, there's usually a little bit of a cooling off period, a honeymoon period before things go to hell. And you have the John Stewart basically getting, just when I thought it was out, they pull me back in more and more. And the Razor and Aya and yeah. So there's in a way the effigy thing by itself is completely pointless, other than the fact that we know somebody freed effigy.
Yeah, it looks like he just disappears into the sun.
Yeah. So, but I mean, somebody set him up to be freed. He makes that crystal clear. Now it's easy to assume it's Krona, but it may not be Krona. It may be because it's so obvious that it would be Krona. Maybe that just means that it isn't. But they give you that mystery, which seemingly, honestly, was the real point, other than Ellie being able to show off her Blue Lantern powers. Which in a way may be part of the reason why, even if you bought the narrative, which, like I said, there's plenty of reasons not to buy the narrative that, hey, we've never seen a Blue do this before, that, you know, she does. She is on a planet that is a Green Lantern. At the same time, she's right next to an enhanced being who happens to be a Green Lantern. So you would think a Blue Lantern would kind of should do pretty well under those circumstances. I don't think St. Walker would do any worse. Well, then again, I shouldn't say that, because the way they write St. Walker, he probably would do worse. But I mean, realistically, you think St. Walker could do everything she did, like with his eyes closed, in a circumstance like that, being pumped up by those two combined?
You think he would be involved with Ellie's training too? But
it's,
I mean,
that whole thing is odd. They're going on their annual pilgrimage. Where? When? When did this come up? I mean, you can make a case the Blue Lanterns have never lasted a year ever, so how could they go on annual pilgrimage? But the point is,
maybe it's another animated series reference.
Maybe, even though he was the only Blue Lantern.
No, Worth.
Oh, yeah. Worth did show up at the end, did he? Yeah. But still, I almost forgot about that. Good catch. All of that seemed odd. That's why I had to reread it, because at first I didn't realize that she had said she went ahead, which makes no sense anyway. Why would you send the most green, all pun intended, Blue Lantern, as someone who's not even a living being? It's like, oh yeah, you go first, unsupervised. And besides, we don't even know how many Blue Lanterns there are at this point. I don't know. It's okay. It's not. At least we give them credit. They picked up on most of the plot lines that they started planting the seeds for, as opposed to, you know, the Jeremy book, which completely kicked the can down the road for all the stuff with Krona last issue.
Yep, sure.
So, all righty.
What's next?
All right, so now we're going to delve into teasers and sizzle reels and all this stuff. So I guess we should talk about, not that there's a hell of a lot to talk about there, because you barely saw anything, but let's talk about like the friggin' like 12 seconds of footage we saw from the Lantern show that came out last week, which was nothing really more than what you see. It looks like a military hangar. It looks like they're having some kind of meeting. It almost looks like a town hall meeting, but it's probably like a briefing in some kind of hangar, and you see John Stewart and Hal Jordan walk in together, and you kind of automatically get the tension between John Stewart and Hal Jordan with the John saying like what he trained for this his whole life, and Hal's like, well, you're like, you're ready when the ring says you are. As he puts the ring in the dashboard when they're in driving together until Hal jumps out and then the vehicle goes off the cliff and John's left in the vehicle essentially having to grab the Green Lantern ring to survive. Didn't like the ring. The ring was kind of odd compared to Guy's. Guy's looked a lot better.
Yes and no. Guy's has the weird tiny gem in the middle of it that sort of breaks up the flow of that ring. Because I've got the prop and everything. And did you get the Hot Topic version of it? The Hot Topic on the necklace?
No, I don't have any version of Guy's ring.
Okay. Because it's the exact same thing as the one that you can buy for like $60 or whatever. That's, you choose your size. It's just one size ring. It's probably like a size 9 or something small like that on a cheap leather cord that you could buy at Hot Topic for like $10. So if anybody out there is looking for the ring, by the way, the one that Guy wore, if you don't plan on actually wearing it, just having it, find the Hot Topic one. It's the exact same thing. But anyways, the way that one looks, that there's the small crystalline looking gem in the middle of the circle part of the Green Lantern symbol. And it really breaks up the flow of that ring. I feel like the flow of this ring is a little cleaner, with the exception of the gold metal borders that sort of block it out a little bit. So I actually like the flow of this ring as opposed to Guy's, I think.
I get it. I'm waiting to be convinced. So at the moment, I still don't think it looks great, but it's possible when we see more of it.
It'll look good like once it's lit up and stuff, but that's all special effects. So yeah. I think we've got enough information and look at it at this point where we can make a determination like stylistically, design wise, we've got all we're ever going to get about it because everything else is special effects. So what do we think of it? I think it's enough for now to make a determination.
Yeah, I can. I'm not impressed, but again, like I said, maybe just getting. Seeing it a little more up close, even without special effects, it might make a difference. If seeing it, it may look more natural. It may look, or it may grow on you. Maybe.
It may be like John's ring. It may be Hal's ring. I don't like, because he puts it on the dash and jumps out of the car. So you would think John would be reaching for his own ring, right? Like, or are they sharing a ring while you train them?
I'm kind of suspecting that might be the case too. At this point in the story, I'm kind of suspecting that might be the case. Or Hal has his on. Hal has his, and John's just for whatever reason, John is refusing to use the ring. He doesn't want to use the ring. And Hal's just, this is just Hal's way of basically forcing him to. Well, the ring chose you, so who the hell are you not to accept, pretty much. So here, now he's putting him in a situation where he doesn't have much of a choice. It's like, yeah, grab the ring or you're going to die, which, of course, is also a problem with that. If for some reason when the car is going off the cliff, if some reason the ring kind of ricochets in a place where you can't grab it.
Yeah.
Or if he's not, or if instinct doesn't take over and he can't literally, and even with, subconsciously can't call the ring to him, then he's going to be dead. But we know that's one of those willing suspension of disbelief kind of things. But who knows? It might actually make more sense plot story wise when we see it.
Yeah. If you're right about that, about like him, what he is doing with John and you need to rely on the ring and stuff. I don't like that because it contradicts what we know about Hal, about how he leaves his ring behind when he test flies. Remember he leaves.
Yeah. Well, Hal does that because it's a crutch. He won't be able to do what he needs to do as a test pilot, knowing that, well, no matter what I do, I'm going to be safe. It would make him arguably even more reckless than he is because he would know there's really no danger.
Yeah.
One thing you and I talked about, I mean, maybe when I see a greater clip of them talking, maybe I will feel differently, but I know you didn't pick up on this, but to me, hearing Kyle Chandler talking to as Hal talking to John, that it almost seemed like he had a little bit of an accent more than Kyle Chandler normally does. Certainly more than he did, let's say in Godzilla. That So maybe it's more natural. Kyle Chandler, like I said, I don't remember how many different things that I've watched him in, but so maybe that's all it is. But it seemed almost like he had a little bit more, almost a little bit more of a drawl than you would expect Hal Jordan to have when he's talking about like the when he's saying about, you know, the ring, you know, the ring decides, the ring lets you know, decides when you're ready. So that just struck me as odd because I wasn't expecting it. But like I said, maybe it's just the way it sounded in that clip. And that since that's literally the only time you hear Hal Jordan talk, and that either way, there's not much to go on here. I mean, we know supposedly there was in one of those HBO things that annoyed people that a full trailer seemingly was going to be released that day, but it never was. But it's really hard to go on this. I mean, I think a common thread in everything we're going to discuss is the old moving the needle concept. Is that is anything really going that we've seen in these things we're going to be discussing truly move the needle dramatically? And I don't think the Green Lantern thing moves the needle at all, because how could it? I mean, it's you see nothing of their powers. You see them together, but not really interacting, other than you get the vibe, as we've already heard, that there's going to be some adversarial aspect to their relationship. And so we have no idea really what they're investigating and why Hal is there. Why, you know, if it's true that Hal's not the one who originally was supposed to be training John, but he kind of got stuck or got literally maybe pulled out of mothballs to do it. We'll see. But it doesn't make me any less interested in the project. But I don't think objectively this can really move the needle for most people. If you were interested in it, you're still interested in it. But if you're on the fence about it, or you're not, or you are needing to be convinced, the Sean Connery from Untouchables, I'm waiting to be impressed, that I don't think there's anything in this trailer that would certainly sway you. Teaser, not really a trailer, the little sizzle reel.
Yeah, look, anybody can choose to opt in or opt out of a project for any reason in terms of whether or not they choose to consume it. That said, I have a hard time seeing anything about this. I mean, it's like what, 18 seconds? Like, it's just, I don't see anything about this that would make anybody go, oh, now I'm in, or even, oh, I'm out.
It's a complete non-needle mover in any direction.
Yeah.
And again, it makes you wonder. I know it was part of an HBO reel, just pushing everything in general, that's going to be coming out in 2026. So you understand why it was included. But I mean, so I guess you had to show something. But most of the stuff all seems like it came from like the same scene, or arguably maybe even the same episode. The interactions, the way they're dressed, where they are. I don't know. Sometimes less is more. And I don't know. It's disappointing because you want to see something. You want to see at least some constructs. But I guess they can get away with justifying not doing that because we already saw Guy in the Superman movie. So it's not like we're not going to know what the constructs should look like, or how the ring can be used. Now, yes, each individual ring should be able to do things slightly different based on the user and how they come, you know, especially with knowing John's background and, you know, like same thing with Kyle, the way they approach to creating things. But still, it's a complete non-needle mover. It's not going to turn you off but it's not going to put anybody who's like, I'm not really sure about this project. It's like, you're right. It's like, yeah, now I'm in. It's like, no. So in a way, it's like, I would consider it a missed opportunity, especially more if it was a full trailer just for Lanterns. And it was kind of this vibe where maybe with 30, 40 seconds, again, mostly the same stuff, no interaction with no powers, nothing that it shows you what the hell they're really dealing with here. Then it would be more of a missed opportunity. But it's, as a first impression, it is kind of eh.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed.
So speaking of, let's delve into Supergirl next.
All right.
Feel free, Chad.
It feels very Guardians.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just from the inclusion of it having Crypto in it so often, I understand, of course, that I don't do what Mark does and read about, you know, what the plot is going to be and look for all the leaks and all that stuff like that. It seems like part of the movie will take place on Earth, part of the movie will take place in space, because obviously Crypto's not with her. He's being watched by Superman back on Earth while she's doing all her stuff. At least if we take the fact the way Superman ended and her finally coming back from her trip. I think this movie is supposed to be her trip and why she left, right? I think that's
I was going to say to you, I don't know if that's been confirmed that this is supposed to be where she is before the end of the movie, or it could be. I guess we'll know, but if you want to believe that that's part of the movie is going to be her journey of kind of becoming less drunk and more responsible than her showing up in the fortress, doesn't necessarily give credence to that. Then maybe that it took place after, but we'll see.
Yeah, I don't know. I just look. I like happy go lucky, you know, sweet Kara Zor-El, but also. I think it makes sense for a young woman of her age when Krypton was destroyed or when Kandor was taken when Kandor was taken as Krypton was destroyed simultaneously. Like, what doesn't really matter what sequence of events or what exactly happened to her. It was all big enough to be traumatic, and it happened to her at an age that she can remember, whereas Kal-El cannot. So it always made sense to me when they did choose to go angry Supergirl route, angry, pissed, mad at the world, which is just a teenager already. But then adding on, you know, one of the last of her race and so on and so forth and everything else that went on with her. So, yeah. How many of us as teenagers wish you had superpowers to punch through a wall or a building or two or, you know, stuff like that, you know? So, like, yeah, I could never fully dismiss it. And I did like it when they kind of went the Red Lantern route with her for a little bit there. But she worked through that. So I'm not expecting her to necessarily work through that. I just maybe necessarily just be better able to handle herself, I guess, more of a grip and understanding of what she wants and who she wants to be. Not necessarily like I'm going to do a 180 and be a great person now. And so, you know, I'm going to be just like Cal, or whatever, but you know, she's still going to get drunk from time to time because she's a young woman and that's what she's going to do. And she wants to have some fun. But maybe she does end up learning something out there. But I say it was very Guardians in that, like, too, it was also not very flashy. You know, her wearing her trench coat all the time instead of just being in the costume and her hair a mess and, you know, the glasses, the sunglasses and all of that stuff. I don't know. I think there's a lot here I could like, and this is the first trailer of a movie we're not seeing for half a year. So there's so much more to be seen. I'm still interested in it. It didn't turn me off the way it did some other people. I'm not intimately familiar with the source material, a Supergirl Woman of Tomorrow from, it was the Rebirth era or whatever, but I know enough about it to where I'd be interested in seeing it adapted. So I don't know. It made me more hesitant. So it, unlike Lanterns, there was a needle move in some direction, but it didn't turn me off either because I like both Supergirls. I like happy-go-lucky Supergirl and, you know, almost stereotypically, oh, yay, girl power, you know, type of Supergirl, and also angry, mad-at-the-world teenager Supergirl. So it just depends on how they do it, I guess, so which at the end of the day works out to remains to be seen.
Yeah, this is even more. This is kind of like the charter member of the things we're talking about tonight in the not moving the needle club. This trailer, you are correct, considering this is not a James Gunn written or James Gunn directed movie. It is an incredibly Guardians like trailer, especially the beginning of the trailer. I mean, I'll throw out the trailer to be fair. I don't mean a little bit with her and Crypto in her apartment or where the hell she is, but especially when she, you know, when she gets confronted when she's drinking and they point the guns at her and all this stuff. This is, again, if you know, it's King, right? Who unfortunately wrote the story. King. This is a King story. Yeah. If you know the story and you like it, then obviously you were excited for this movie to begin with because you know this is what the movie is based on. So this trailer is obviously going to be preaching to the choir. If you know what the story is about and you don't, and you're either neutral on it or you don't like that version of Supergirl, or you know absolutely nothing about that story, and you just saw her drunk in Superman, and now seeing her drunk again, is this movie, with the ever brief glimpse of, you know, laying down the breadcrumbs of why probably she's the way she is, and even though she's like 23 or about to be 23, that she's acting out, if you will, in why she's doing that. While they kind of lay the breadcrumbs for you, where you probably will understand and feel and be able to relate a little bit more to it, is this trailer going to move the needle for the ones that either don't like the story, don't know the story? No, it's not going to do that. And Millie Alcock is one of the best things. I think she's actually the thing working in this movie's favor the most. And even that, do you have the problem? Is because people really liked, I think, generally speaking, Sasha Calle's Supergirl from the Flash movie. I think most people thought that was
one of the only positive things.
I do like that movie. I think more than a lot of people do. I appreciate. It was flawed, but I enjoyed it. But yeah, her and Michael Keaton were by far the biggest things, the biggest assets that movie had. So people, even though, again, does she look like Supergirl? No, she absolutely looked nothing like traditional historical Supergirl. But Sasha, people liked that version. They understood that character, and there was a lot of potential with her. So in a way, that could work a little bit against Millie Alcock playing the non-traditional version of Supergirl, even though she looks the role. But, you know, the drunken acting out, you know, still acting like a teenager, even though you're technically not anymore. That all being said, this kind of hit me as far as my analogies. This was my showing my age. And for those who know, I remember watching Facts of Life when I was a kid, and Lisa Welchel's Blair often had these moments when she goes, "I've just had another one of my brilliant ideas," and I'm kind of tongue in cheek here. And one of my better analogies lately, I've thought about this, is that trailers for movies, like an entire trailer package for a movie and everything they're going to put out, it's kind of like at bats in a baseball game, that you only have a limited number of at bats or a limited number of trailers to be able to get the job done and to make an impact. So every time you have one and it doesn't do that, even if in theory what you do is serviceable, sometimes you may look back at it and go, well, it's a missed opportunity. Even if it's a teaser trailer, which we know historically teaser trailers are only there to remind people that the project's coming and kind of like to whet your appetite a little bit. But certain projects, as we know, need more heavy lifting than others. So having something that is lukewarm when you could have gone a little bit more, you know, pardon the term, balls to the wall, it could be problematic. Like Supergirl was, it's serviceable. It was a serviceable trailer. So continuing the analogy, it's like coming up in the bottom of the first, there's runners on first and second, nobody out. The count's 3-1. And you take a borderline pitch. It could be called a strike, could be a ball. But you take it, and you could handle it. You know it's in your zone. You could do something with the pitch, but you choose not to swing at the last minute, and you walk. Your at-bat was fine. Your bases loaded, nobody out. But then the next guy strikes out. The guy after that hits into a double play. You get nothing out of the inning, and you end up losing the game by a run, and you go back, man, I should have swung at that pitch, because considering the way it happened, it was a missed opportunity. And that's kind of that's what I feel like sometimes when these trailers are okay, but not spectacular for movies. And this project needs a little bit. This needs certainly more lifting than Superman did or Batman did, because you got a built-in audience for that. It's a teaser. You have time. This movie doesn't come out till June. But again, this is not a needle mover one way or the other. And it's okay to me. So I just think, and I think that's a common, I think they could have, especially knowing that your trailer in general is, and maybe this is why they did this. You could justify it this way in the opposite direction. I was going to say, knowing your trailer is about to get completely swallowed up by Avengers Doomsday anyway, that you might have wanted to make a bigger impact for the week plus that you had. You kind of had it to yourself, which of course, as it turned out, they didn't really have a full week. But the reality is, you could make a case they should have maybe swung a little bit more for the fences than just being a little passive and saying, but you could justify it and say, well, we know it's going to get swallowed up, so let's wait till we have a little more breathing room, and then we'll put something out that we think will start moving the needle in our favor because we have time. But
yeah, I've also just seen some criticism online that is mad at just Millie Adcock being Supergirl in the fact that she's not like an absolute bombshell.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, I don't, what? Well, first of all, she's not an unattractive girl.
Nope.
And second of all, not every superhero girl needs to have like an inch short skirt and be your freaking spank bank material. Like, holy God, like not everybody needs to be a drop dead gorgeous model on everyone who becomes a superhero on both sides of the gender equation. We don't have to have, you know, the freaking Abercrombie and Fitch looking shirtless dudes as superheroes all the damn time. But yeah, so like there's debate up there about this movie that just is just clouding all of this just because people are stupid. The other thing I will say is I also thought about it. I wasn't watching the trailer, but I kind of had it replaying in my mind's eye. You know, it's not just it felt James Gunn, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy. Yes, it also felt Taika Waititi, Ragnarok-esque.
Yeah, I would. Those movies do have similar general tones, I would say.
Yeah. No, I was just also thinking because now I know this is a specific character arc, not necessarily like they're doing the exact same thing. But I see in Supergirl in this trailer what I saw in early Valkyrie in Ragnarok, especially when she lands the ship and stumbles out and falls off the platform. Yeah. Like I see that moment almost verbatim potentially being recreated in this Supergirl movie and wouldn't bat an eye based on the trailer we got.
Yeah. See, I don't personally get criticism. I mean, I get it if you're just doing it from an eye candy perspective. I get that. Hey, you would. Then again, she's not playing Power Girl. If you're playing Power Girl, then it's like, yeah, it's like, would you want someone at least built physically more like Sydney Sweeney if he was playing Power Girl? Theoretically, yes, because it matches how the character is typically portrayed. But if you look at Supergirl, you could have someone who's a little, you know, theoretically that's a little more ripped but then again, it doesn't really. I think she's one of the best things working in this. I think she is the thing working in this movie's favor. I mean, some people think the story is
talented, and she's not a bad looking person.
No, so, and she yeah. And people and she had the big and she had the has the benefit of House of the Dragon working in her favor, and most people I think still think that she's the better of the two Rhaenyras. Yes, they had to age her based on the story that she was never going to be able to portray older Rhaenyra like she did younger, but I think most people still prefer her version of the character. But I think she's what's working in this movie's favor, not the Tom King thing. Some people like that story. Some people like Tom King. I don't like Tom King. I never read the story. Even if a lot of people, regardless of whether you know King or don't like, or know King and like him, dislike him, or don't know him, the reality is this kind of story is not going to work for everybody the way they're going to portray this character. But I think she is a thing working in its favor, and I think so. It annoys me still, though. I suspect it's the vocal minority, that the people who still are moaning and bitching about RDJ being Dr. Doom, when it's like, dude, I mean, he's like one of the few positive things working in that movie's favor heading into it, is that we know he can act, and and there are absolute elements of his portrayal of Iron Man that you could see carry over into a straight up Doctor Doom portrayal, even without tying any of the characters together at all. So that he's capable of playing a role like that. And if Doom can't really help carry that movie, you're going to have a lot of problems. So who else would you rather cast? But I don't know. Yeah.
All right, what's next?
So following that, let's roll into this. We won't talk about this too much because Chad doesn't really want to talk about
it. Not much to talk about, honestly.
I was going
to
say, but Chad doesn't really want to talk about it at all. But
no, objectively, there's not much to talk about.
No, yeah, I know, but there's more to talk about it in theory than there was about Lanterns. It's just that Lanterns is our thing. So as the rumors have been going on for the last few weeks, that from the idea that, oh, we were getting an event. I mean, it's pretty much been a foregone conclusion. We were getting a Doomsday trailer attached to Avatar for self-serving reasons for a long time. But then a few weeks ago, it was like, okay, no, they're going to be releasing one trailer a week. And the ultimate self-serving gimmick, which is only interesting from the perspective of what percentage of their decision to do this is because they know Doomsday needs this, or because they think Avatar needs it because the domestic numbers are looking softer. You know, it's almost guaranteed to be a combination of both. The question is, where's the split? Is it like 60-40 or is it like 70-30 in favor of, yeah, we know we Marvel, Disney, we know this needs heavy, heavy lifting to rebuild the interest in the MCU before Doomsday comes out. So that all being said, while there was speculation about what the four trailers were going to be, seemingly, and I believe it, Chad's more skeptical, but I think this, we're going to, by the time this episode comes out, we're going to know whether it's true or not, which means we could always cut this part out if it turns out to be not true. But the first of the four trailers were leaked earlier. We're recording this on Wednesday, the 17th. I think it was on Monday, the 15th. I believe these things, that the trailer leaked, kind of pseudo trailer leaked, which would make sense again, because knowing the way how things work at the theaters, that if these trailers were locked, that they probably wouldn't be given the codes to unlock the trailers until this week, because that's when you got to start building your trailer package. And even digitally, you would need to be able to unlock that trailer, which means somebody's going to be watching the trailer because you still run things down anyway. Like, because your file could always be corrupted. Now, that's what it's basically for now. In the old days, was making sure everything, all the reels got spliced together properly. But now it's to make sure, like, your files didn't get corrupted. So it makes perfect sense that somebody running this down, that somebody would take videos of this, because hey, they know people would be interested. But if what we saw was true, then the first of the four Avengers trailers that we are seemingly going to get is the not shocking confirmation of the return of Steve Rogers, our Steve Rogers, the real Captain America that we last saw at the end of Endgame, is in his prime, that he is going to be returning in Doomsday. Him obviously with some time passing, and now that he has I think it's a son, but either way, it's showing him holding his baby with him and Peggy. And there is that Doomsday clock kicking down at the end, which of course, until we see the second trailer, we probably aren't going to really have a better idea what the progression is, I guess, in the countdown.
Sorry, you said Doomsday clock and I had flashbacks.
Yeah, I know. It's not particularly original, but then again, to be fair, Watchmen did not invent the concept of the Doomsday Clock either. It's just probably the best known comic book use of it, but it's not like they invented it. If this trailer is real, and I do suspect that it is, but the most interesting thing about it is the fact that by all accounts, the first trailer we were going to get was going to be the Doctor Doom trailer. So if this is true, and they switched and they released the Steve Rogers trailer first, that probably tells you a lot about what they feel is wrong and right about the MCU right now, and what can probably generate the most interest, because the second trailer is supposed to be the Thor trailer, and Doom, I think, has been pushed back to number three. So you went from having Doom supposedly be the initial trailer to now potentially being the third trailer, which makes it seem like they don't have a lot of confidence potentially that Doom is going to be able to carry this movie from a promotional perspective, at least in the early stages, on his own. Steve Rogers is smart. Do I think it's a big needle mover going with the theme of this segment? No, but it moves the needle a little bit, because it's the official confirmation of what a lot of people have, what has been rumored for a while, that Steve and what him going back in time with Peggy is going to be a catalyst somehow to some of the events that we're dealing with in Doomsday, and how essentially Doomsday is going to be almost a direct sequel to Endgame. Oh, by which we should point out, Endgame is being re-released in September, which supposedly, rumor has it, in quotes, because there never wasn't a post-credit scene in Endgame. But now there's supposed to be a post-credit scene, which is going to be new, which will tie directly into Doomsday. But it's just confirmation that Steve Rogers, the real Captain America, is coming back and is going to be a factor in Doomsday, which will excite people to a large extent. Some people will say, well, it kind of ruined his happy ending, but we don't know how that's going to play out. Old man Steve Rogers at the end of Endgame could have been post-Secret Wars. Everything played out, or he could have lived. So he could have gone back, and we don't know. But the reality is, I think it's smart on that level. Once you go with Steve first, I guess it makes sense. You probably should go with Thor second, because those are literally the only two of the original Avengers that people probably really give a shit about at this point, unless they bring Hawkeye back and there's no evidence he's coming back yet. So probably he would be at some point, maybe in Secret Wars. But so that's it. There is absolutely no. It was kind of cool seeing him pack up the suit and put it away. Which, of course, is foreshadowing the fact that he's going to have to put it back on again. but it is kind of cool. But it is, it's just the symbolic act of basically closing the door on that chapter of his life and moving on. And obviously, well, it's like Hugh Jackman, till you're 90.
Yeah. I think some of the discourse online is like, oh, my God, he's got a kid. And I'm like, really? That you're freaking out about that? You could have extrapolated that from the fact that Peggy had a whole ass family.
Agreed. Yes. Depending on which view of the time travel, whether that was always meant to happen, which is, if you believe some of the rumors, that's kind of what got the Russos back into the concept of doing this movie in Secret Wars, was because the Russos and the writers of Endgame were never 100% in sync about what Steve Rogers going back in time to be with Peggy actually meant, whether it was creating something new or whether this was basically a loop that was always supposed to happen. So yes, but yes, technically we know Peggy had kids and Peggy was married. So that's not necessarily changing the status quo technically.
Yeah. So really all this is confirming Steve will be in the film, as you said. And for me, that's not shocking. I could have guessed that.
Yeah.
So, you know, whether or not it's real or not, if it is real, it doesn't matter. And if it's not real, it also doesn't matter. So, like, that's why I don't care to really extrapolate much on it.
Yeah, I mean, I do believe it's real. It make, like I said, the timing makes sense, because, and also, yeah, I mean, if somebody really wanted their footage to look real, that, I mean, to make it more believable, that's kind of what you would do, is that you would take something and then try to make it look as shitty as possible, because that's why it would be recorded, because you know you're not going to be able to just... You're not going to just be able to upload it, especially if it's in the theater. You're not going to just be able to download it onto your phone, the file onto your phone, because that's not the way these things work. But I think that, considering, like you mentioned and we talked about, there have been so many fake trailers, even though, to be fair, a lot of these trailers, if you read the descriptions, they denote that it's a fan concept trailer.
Yeah.
But I think this does make sense. You know, with the clock and the fonts, everything, it does make sense. The fact that the 4-1 has, you know, the contents of that seem pretty, have been pretty consistent. I believe it. Like I said, as we're recording this, it's the 17th. By tomorrow, the 18th, we should know, because, you know, once people start seeing Avatar, some people are going to upload this trailer, even if they end up getting ceased and desist by Disney shortly thereafter. It's going to be out there, and once it's out there, it's going to be confirmation, just like when No Way Home opened. By early Thursday afternoon, you had if you were on YouTube, you were already able to see the Toby and the Andrew Garfield scene, so you knew the confirmation they were in the movie by like early afternoon on Thursday because of, or even maybe late Wednesday night because of the movie opening up. I think it opening up overseas first, that there were already things that were uploaded confirmation. So we're gonna know. Probably within less than 24 hours, because somebody's going to post this from the actual seeing Avatar.
Oh, but, yeah, and Brand New Day leaked too, apparently.
Yes. I was going to mention, which, if you want to talk about an even shittier version of it, I mean, I've heard people
describe it. Yeah, I saw the first few seconds, and I was like, I'm not watching this.
Yeah, I watched one description of a pretty reliable site describing it, what was in it, and I didn't watch the Campia. I know Campia talked about it too. But and do I think that's real too? Yeah, I think that's completely real too. I mean, I don't think it's finished. I think they kind of denoted that some of the special effects weren't finished in it yet. But do I think that was probably real too? Yeah, which is curious, because it makes you wonder who that one is. Really, especially curious, because that one's a little more puzzling, because you would think, if we're really getting 4 Avengers trailers in 4 weeks, that we at least would be 3 more weeks away before they consider putting out a Spider-Man trailer. I don't know, but yeah, it's been a big week for leaked trailers. So we're going to know probably, like I said, we'll know by tomorrow one way or the other if this was a very, very nicely done hoax, or whether it really was the first trailer. But I figured it was worth discussing.
All right, what else we got?
Before we wrap up ever so briefly, and what I've seen, the only thing that I've seen was not theatrically. I saw the third Knives Out movie. I saw Wake Up Dead Man. And while I will openly admit I may be in the minority here, I think this was my least favorite of the three. And I know some people have said that this is oh, the main character is the most sympathetic and relatable character. And it's like, it's more relatable and probably likable because of the nature of the story than Janelle Monáe's character in the second one. But I don't, it's hard for me to say the priest is more likable and more relatable than Ana de Armas' character in the first movie. And not just because it's Ana de Armas. I think her character was really, really, really sympathetic and understandable in that movie. I also, it got better. I thought it was very slow to start with. And I didn't really like I didn't like many of the characters actually in it to start with. But the one thing I will admit, while I didn't have all the pieces put together, when I saw one character in particular, which factors into the resolution of the mystery, as soon as I saw that character introduced, I said, that character is, I would be stunned if that character isn't the, you know, the driving force of what's going on. So to me, when people say, wow, you'll never figure it out, that's not my reaction. I kind of figured that the main part out right away. I think I did the first one too, but that's probably just because because it's Rian Johnson and it's always subverting expectation with Rian Johnson. So having Chris Evans be the bad guy because it's so out of character for him to be the bad guy, that's probably why it made sense. I suspected it was Chris Evans all along. Plus he kind of played a dick, but by the trailer you kind of knew he played a dick. So I guess it kind of made sense then. But it's worth watching if you like the other two, or if you, regardless of which, if you liked them equally, if you liked the first, but you were a little turned off by the second because it was a little more humorous, I think it's worth watching. And that's it on my end.
Yeah, I saw 8-Bit Christmas. I liked it. I wasn't wowed by it like a lot of people said it would. It's a feel-good Christmas movie. What Christmas movie is not feel-good? It just, at least it wasn't cheesy and crappy, kind of like, you know, your atypical Lifetime original 50 Christmas movies you get a year type of thing. So it's better than that, but not necessarily something I'll be like, oh man, I gotta watch that every year from now on, like Klaus on Netflix was for me when I first saw it. So
no, I get it, man. I get it. So I guess that's it for tonight. So if you'd like to contact us, let us know your thoughts on either the issue or any of these trailers. LanternCast.com. The email is LanternCast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Blue Sky, Twitter, like us on Facebook, hashtag GLCast to track us down. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, wherever you listen to us on. Please leave us a positive review. Last but not least, if you'd like to leave us, as mentioned, a text or a voicemail, besides being able to email us, if you'd like to leave us a text or a voicemail, 708-LANTERN, and let us know what you think.
And Merry Christmas, everybody.
Yes, I was going to say that, too. Have a very, very Merry Christmas, and we will talk to you soon.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.